Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Adesk, to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And today is Wednesday, June 22nd, 2016. Good afternoon, Al.
Hi, Melody.
Well, all eyes are still on Brexit, and we'll be talking a little bit about that right after the first segment, we'll have Wendy Wilson from Apothecary Herbs joining us. But first, let's do the market reports. We have gold today. It's holding that 1267 for gold, 1267 for gold, down 170. It's been fluctuating a lot around that level in the 60s, in the 1260s. So holding 1267, and I think that's pretty much what we're going to see, even if they decide to stay. Silver was down 2 cents today at 1734. Platinum was down 3 at 980. And we have palladium up 9 at 563. The USDX today is trading down 0.32 at 93.73. We have crude oil down 0.74 at 49.11. And the paper markets today, let's go to the paper markets. We have the Dow down 48 points at 17,780. You have the NASDAQ down 10 at 48.33. And the S&P down 3 at 2,085. 10-year yield down 0.01 at 1.68. Euro still holding at 113, even though it's still up, trading within that range of the 113, up 0.54. And I guess the European markets are enjoying their hope that they remain, as their markets were stronger overnight. And I actually read something briefly that they had stopped trading in England. I couldn't find any place to confirm that. So, but I'm interested. I thought it was interesting if they had actually done that prior to this vote on this referendum Thursday. So, anyway, we'll talk about that soon. First, we have Wendy Wilson from Apothecary Herbs joining us. Good afternoon, Wendy.
Good afternoon, Melody, and hello, Al.
Hello, Wendy.
How's it going?
Good.
I thought we'd talk about some research science has done on the power of prayer affecting your health, and also, if we get time, a little information on a really great herb that gives us a lot of health advantages. But first, we hear people go to the doctor for more for the following problems: depression, hypertension, ulcers, headache, stress, and anxiety. And you know, there are some health principles that can help us out if we follow them. Things like, you know, eating better, getting regular exercise, and avoiding the sugar and excess alcohol and drugs, and also get adequate sleep. But a lot of people aren't following that real closely. And the health industry, though, on the other hand, feels, get this, that healthy principles, Al, Melanie, involve healthcare coverage for everybody. Well, science has conducted some new research on the power of prayer affecting your health. They had a limited idea why prayer helps people heal faster, have lower blood pressure, and less mental illness. Now, in 2013, the peer review poll, research poll, found that 50% of Americans pray every day, and 75% feel that prayer was a very important element in order to have a good life. So science was intrigued by this notion, and they wanted to figure out somehow some way of measuring the tangible effects of prayer. I was just cracking up at that, but that's okay. Scientists reported their findings in the Journal of Psychology Today. They said they found five elements. Anybody want to guess what those five elements were with regards to health and prayer?
I have no idea.
No idea. Okay, well, they went about it very scientifically, and they said that people who pray, guess this, they have better self-control. Yep, they found that people who pray have more control over life's situations. They concluded that this is a behavior that took practice, and the more they practiced it, the better they became. So they were less likely to be mentally exhausted or lose their temper or engage in behaviors which created dependencies on food, tobacco, alcohol, or drugs. The researchers were quite astonished to find that participants in their study that prayed before they took on a challenging task were more energized and successful in completing it. Number two is they said that people who prayed had improved demeanor. Researchers said that those who prayed were nicer to deal with. They had less arrogance, aggression, and anger. Number three is they were more forgiving. Those who prayed, they said, were willing to forgive and pray for those who needed prayer or for those who offended them. The number four was that prayer increased trust. The study showed that praying or praying with someone increased trust and unity. So they concluded that prayer brings people closer together. So that old adage that the family that prays together stays together now has been scientifically proven. And the fifth thing they found was prayer affects your health. The team determined that people who prayed were not as likely to have negative emotions to impact their health. So individuals who prayed had less stress, which is really a major risk factor with regards to disease. They also found that those who prayed, were less stressed financially. So these are all measurable benefits with having faith. And the University of Rochester study, they also found that 85% of people who prayed when they faced an illness crisis or an illness crisis for somebody they cared about. So guess what? Prayer is the most widespread universal alternative therapy for health. What do you think?
It's pretty amazing. I mean, it's an amazing report, in part because most people would think that prayer might have a 20% effect.
And we're
just
suggesting
is that it can have an 85% effect. I mean, it's not where a small effect you can say, well, maybe it's prayer and maybe it's random.
Mm-hmm.
But the numbers you're suggesting they pretty much tell you that prayer is real.
Right, and it gets better.
It's not just psychosomatic. Okay, go ahead.
I know, the scientists weren't done. No, vascular cardiologist Dr. Hubert Benson of Harvard Medical School, he was researching numerous double-blind studies regarding the influence of prayer on health, and he concluded that there is a strong connection between the mind and body, and that prayer produces what he calls the, quote, relaxation response. So he reported that during prayer, the mind and body relax, and the metabolism slows down. The heart rate decreases. The blood pressure decreases. The breathing slows and becomes consistent and calm. So he reported that our brain waves also correlate with this slower metabolism, and they slow down, and it offers the person a feeling of control, alertness, and has a peaceful mind. So I guess it's kind of hard to freak out when you're in prayer, right? And then also, according to Dr. Andrew Newberg, he's the director of the Center for Spirituality and Mind at the University of Pennsylvania. He says your brain does have healing power. He went to Tibet. He studied the Tibetan Buddhists. He studied the Franciscan nuns and power prayer over health. And his research said that it decreases what happens is there's a decreased activity in certain parts of the brain when someone is engaged in prayer. He says the part of the brain this occurs in is the area where scientists say is our awareness of self. And then he also said that when this is happening, there's also an increase in dopamine levels, which is involved in the feeling of well-being and joy.
You say and, increase or decrease?
An increase in dopamine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And now putting this information to the test, Dr. Kenneth Pargament, professor of psychology at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, he took some headache patients and separated them into two groups. One group, he instructed them to pray and say frequently that God is good, God is peace, God is love. The other group, he instructed them to say something non-spiritual, such as grass is green and sand is soft. And those who prayed, he said, and spoke of God's goodness had fewer headaches and were able to tolerate pain better than the other group. But then the scientist says, yes, 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 but does it last? Are these lasting benefits or is it just temporary? Well, the National Institute of Health set out to answer that. And what they found that after individuals prayed, their health benefits continued. Scientifically speaking, those who prayed regularly reduced their risk of hypertension by 40%. The research team at Dartmouth Medical School reported that heart patients that underwent heart surgery and who prayed improved their chances of making a recovery by threefold. And in 2011, the University of Cincinnati reported that asthma patients who prayed had fewer and less severe asthma attacks compared to those who did not. And the Journal of Geriatry reported that out of 4,000 senior citizens in Durham, North Carolina, in that study, they found that those who prayed seemed to cope better with their illness and lived longer than those that didn't. So they also said science says it does improve your immune system response, and it lessens the severity of lots of illnesses. So, well, if you're going to improve your immune system, you're going to have a better chance at staying well and being well. But I want to go back to Dr. Benson, the cardiologist, for just a second. He also wanted to document the physiological mechanisms that prayer seems to, you know, impact or have an influence over. What he reported was when we pray long-term, regular prayer, we deactivate the genes which trigger inflammation and which encourage cell death. Okay? So, he and his teammates were astonished that your mind can influence gene expression and impact physical functions that science wishes it could control. So it slows down your dying mechanism, is what he's saying. It helps engage in prevention of inflammation and prevents a lot of cell death. I thought that was cool.
Oh, I think it's spectacular.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, power of prayer, but, you know, you got to be sincere in your prayer. You know, you can't fool God. He can see into the hearts of men. So you don't give him lip service. You got to be in sincere prayer if you're going to use prayer to be healthy. If we got a second, we can talk about this one particular herb that can also give us advantages because God gave us herbs too, medicinal ones. And this particular herb you probably won't see often as a supplement in stores. You definitely won't see it overseas. This herb is lobelia. And the reason it's an herb that you don't see often is because it has a lot of power in it. So God has created this particular herb with 16 alkaloids, which is a lot for an herb.
And how do you spell the name?
Lobelia.
Okay.
It is grown and cultivated here in the United States. The FDA doesn't like it much. It's not on its grass list, and I can explain that later. But the beauty of this herb is that it offers a purging of toxins while it protects you from using too much. So it has a safety alkaloid built into it, making it impossible for you to overdose on it. Now, the ancients used this herb, but it wasn't really rediscovered by modern herbalists until the 1700s. So the herbalist to put this herb into the spotlight was Samuel Thompson. And he discovered in his writings, he wrote about it, he discovered it as an 8-year-old boy, but really didn't think much about it until 20 years later when he gave it to a coworker. And the coworker said that he sweated out a bunch of toxins and then never felt better. So after that, he kind of used the plant more in his work, and he recorded a lot of the healing benefits of it, and he wound up using that herb with cayenne. So with just lobelia and cayenne, he reported that he was able to help over 1 million American colonists get better. And the reason is one promotes circulation and one promotes the evacuation of toxins.
And when we talk about the evacuation of toxins, mm-hmm. are we always talking about you sweating them out coming out through your skin? Or are there
right.
something that you...
Right. Well, a lobelia has a very distinct signature taste. So if you ever taste it, it has this prickly sensation it gives to the back of your throat. It doesn't last. It's there for just a few moments and it's gone. I personally like it in a liquid tincture because it's easier to adjust the dose rather than in a tea or tincture. So if you're going to use it in a liquid tincture, it has to be aged in two different catalysts. So it grabs all 16 alkaloids so it works properly. And this is why you probably won't see supplement manufacturers dealing with it because it takes an extra step to make it properly.
To make the tincture. It takes
an extra
step to make the tincture properly. But we will be able to find lobelia on the shelves someplace or we'll be able to order it. True?
Right. Yeah, we have it. It's a liquid. We call it relaxation formula. It does a lot of things. The alkaloids in the body see your system reads the chemical consistency of the herb, and then it'll tap into which alkaloid it needs. So in other words, let's say you have congestion. There's an alkaloid in lobelia that works as a decongestant. If you have muscle spasms and tension, there's an alkaloid that works like an antispasmodic. If you have fluid retention, edema, there's an alkaloid in it that the body can use as a diuretic. So it has lots of uses, and it was used for all these things and a whole bunch more. And especially you can pair it up with other herbs, and it just works fabulously as well. I like to use it with my echinacea root formulas as I address pneumonia congestion with those two formulas, the lobelia relax formula and the echinacea. So it has lots of uses, and I think people, you know, if we could get back to a lot of what the ancients did and used, we could really sidestep a lot of problems. And we call it the thinking herb. Our herbalists call it the thinking herb because of that, because it has so much to offer and the body taps into just what it needs. So they call it the thinking herb.
That's pretty amazing. That's really.
I know.
I mean, it's.
Let me tell you real quickly, if I can, why the FDA doesn't like it. What they did is they took like 30 pounds of the lobelia and extracted just the strongest alkaloid from it, distilled it into a serum, stuck it in a syringe, pumped it into a rat, and watched the rat die. So that's why they don't like it.
Huh.
And that's just not the way you use lobelia.
All right. It's not intended to be injected. It is.
Well, I mean, they only took one alkaloid,
ingested.
See? Yeah. They only took one alkaloid out of it, and that's how you make drugs.
I see.
But when you use whole food, you get a balance, and it doesn't work like that. So, but if people are interested, they can get some liquid lobelia called Relax Formula from the folks at Apothecary Herbs, thepowerherbs.com, or they can call toll-free at 866-229-3663. And, of course, don't neglect the power of prayer.
Thank you, Wendy. Fascinating information. We'll look forward to talking to you again next Wednesday. That's
bye-bye.
Wendy Wilson from thepowerherbs.com. 866-229-3663. Give her a call. I'm Alfred Addisk here with Melody Cederstrom on financial survival, and we will be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs Emotional Stress Formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. What's next, Melody?
I have a little special here, 90% silver dimes, $50 face value. You receive, it's about a little over 35 ounces of silver. So you get a nice chunk of silver. The 90% silver, it's dimes, and an AU $5 Liberty gold piece for the low, low price, and this includes your shipping costs of $995. $995 for $50 face value, 90% dimes, an almost uncirculated $5 Liberty gold piece. Includes your shipping costs for $995. So all you have to do is call us, visit our website at dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for a weekly newsletter. And if you have any emails you'd like to direct to me, send them to discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com. discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com. And if you choose, you can go to the website and you can email me directly from the website if you'd like, and that is dgscoins.com.
Okay, we've got a couple of articles. I've got a couple of articles on unemployment here. All right. And they're interesting. There's something to be gathered from both of them. One of them is from U.S. News and World Report, which says that according to government statistics, while the U.S. economy continued to shed positions well after the Great Recession ended in 2009, and I'm not convinced that it ended then, if ever. But in any case, they say after the Great Recession ended in 2009, the country has created more than 14 million new jobs. All right? There are more Americans working nowadays than has ever been the case, and the country's unemployment rate last month dropped to a multi-year low of 4.7%, or at least that's what they claim. The article goes on and says, however, the government statistics don't tell the whole story of what's happening in the domestic economy. It's not an accurate reflection of the marketplace. It hasn't been for years. The reality is we need a lot more jobs than we have. That's a statement from one of the people who was featured in the article who had a successful career and suddenly found himself unemployed, lost his house, one thing another, lost his house, lost his car. Bad things happened to him in the midst of a significant bout of unemployment. So he didn't agree with the government statistics. He says we need a lot more jobs than we have. And I don't necessarily agree with his conclusion. It could be that we need a lot fewer workers than we have. And as in, we don't need as many illegal aliens as we have who are taking jobs. When they weren't taking jobs, there'd be more jobs available for the people who belong in this country. And there's another alternative. We may not need more jobs. We could get by if we had higher take-home pay, which is something that could flow from lower taxes, and we'll talk about that a little more in a moment. Bureau of Labor Statistics' much-followed unemployment rate only tracks individuals who don't have a job and have actively looked for work in the past 4 weeks. So although the rate moved down in May, several analysts think this is because many Americans simply stopped looking for work. On the surface, a decline in the unemployment rate suggests improvement in hiring, as more of the unemployed are put back to work. This, according to Lindsay Piegza, chief economist for Stifel Fixed Income. And she says, this time, however, the decline in unemployment and the unemployment rate was the result of hundreds of thousands of Americans dropping out of the labor force rather than finding gainful employment. As all of you have heard and understand, I expect virtually all of you understand this, the government's formula for calculating unemployed, they don't count. If you've been unemployed for over 4 weeks and you're not looking for a job, they drop you. You're not counted as unemployed. You're just a non-person, all right? I don't know what's going to happen to you, but you're not unemployed because you haven't looked for a job for over a month. And the result is the government is able to come up with numbers where they suggest that the unemployment rate is 4.7%, while there are millions of Americans who would like to have a job but don't. Huh? But they're not being counted, and that's part of the, and here we have, we've heard this before, but here's a story from mainstream media that's admitting this. What I wonder about, what are these people doing? We've got millions of people who are presumably, who are not looking for jobs, not employed. How are they getting by? Is there a black market? Are they working for cash wages that's all under the table and the employer hires you to be a waitress or a waiter at a particular restaurant? They pay you cash, doesn't get reported on anyone's income tax. I mean, these people who supposedly don't have jobs, they're doing something. Is it welfare? Is that what's supporting these people? Is that why people are not looking for work? I don't need a job. Government sends me a check every month. Why should I work? I can get by on this check. I wonder what's really going on because there's a mystery here, in my opinion. Total number of Americans not counted in the labor force, some of whom were retired or in school, but others were likely to have given up trying to land a job, climbed by more than 660,000 last month to roughly 94.7 million. Now, 320 million Americans in this country, population 320 million or thereabouts, If we subtract 95 million who are not working, this apparently includes children and retired and so on, we still have 225 million American workers, which is about 70% of Americans that have jobs, full or part-time. Now, this is interesting to me because most people think that we need more jobs, and that's not necessarily true. I wrote an article that was entitled Big back in the early 1990s. It's got to be over, what, go back to 1993, 94, something like that. Back then, we didn't have the internet, but you could call a public library for information. You can call down to the Dallas Public Library and say, how many, what's the birth rate? How many people were born in Saskatchewan in 1955? They had researchers there that would go through the books in the library, and they would find an answer, and they'd get back to you. It's a way of finding information. I asked them, what's the, how many people were employed in this country when I was a little boy back in the 1950s? And they said it was about 30%. And at the time I asked, it had grown to about 55%, right? In the 1950s, we were the richest nation on earth, and only about 30% of us had jobs. By the 1990s, we were on the skids, right? We were going down. And as we became more or less prosperous, we also became more employed. We had higher numbers. It went from 30% when I was a boy to 55% in the 1990s. And according to the report I'm reading right now, it's about 70% of us have jobs full or part-time. That's the implication of their numbers. Now, the point I'm trying to illustrate is we are headed toward full employment. And we have a man who lost his job and his house and one thing and another like that. And he says, we need more jobs. I'm saying, no, we don't. I won't say that we absolutely don't, but let's just put this comparison out where people can understand it. When we were the wealthiest nation on earth, only 30% of us needed to have jobs. The husband was the breadwinner. He went out and had a job. He brought home enough money to support the wife and the kids. Mom didn't have to work. We could have a stay-at-home mom because dad made enough money. When we were the richest country on earth, he made enough to support the family. But as taxes have increased, when I was a little boy, my dad's tax burden was about 15% of his gross. State, local, and federal taxes took about 15% of his money. Today, or at least in 1993 thereabouts, the tax rate had run up to where it was about 50%. And this is the explanation. This is why mom needs to work. It's because government has grown and imposed more taxes. It used to be one man got to keep 85 cents out of every dollar he worked. By 1950, he only got to keep about 50 cents out of every dollar that he'd earned. All right. As a result, it took two people working to generate a standard of living that my father could generate all by himself back in the 1950s. We are being slowly pushed into poverty by increasing growth of government. As tax rates rise, when Bill Clinton was in office, he made a comment at one point where he predicted that the next generation would pay 80% of their income would go to government. Think about that. My dad paid 15%. Bill Clinton is anticipating that you and I are going to pay 80%. I don't think we are yet, but by the time you get done with the state taxes and the local taxes and the federal taxes and the hidden taxes that are built into everything, the majority of your income right now is going to support the government. And as a result, there's not enough left for people, everyone to have jobs. There's not enough left for people to spend. And the government wants us to stimulate the economy by going out and spending. Well, how about you cut taxes and get off our backs? When we had less government, we were more prosperous. Now we have bigger government, and it promises to do more and more wonderful things for us, like the Obamacare, which is going to do what? It increases the cost of medical assistance for most of the people in this country. It becomes a burden rather than a blessing. Some people get over with it, but the majority do not. And this is just one example, classic example, but one example of government is here to help you. No, they're not. They're here to take your money. That's what they're here for. Well, this article talking about unemployment, right? And government has this, they're saying, oh, unemployment is only 4.7%. That's nonsense. We've talked, John Williams at shadowstats.com, I mentioned it probably once a week. He's calculated that the real unemployment rate is closer to 23%. Donald Trump, he's weighed in on this recently, where he says he claims that it's closer to 42%. I don't believe that for a minute. I think Williams is right, though. 23%, and certainly I don't believe in government's 4.7%. And they get to this 4.7% by not counting everybody who's unemployed. They say, you don't have a job? When was the last time you looked? You haven't looked in the last month? You're not unemployed. You're just, lazy or something like that. It wasn't the problem. If you wanted a job in the 50s, you could have had a job. And you made a good living off of it. You know, my first job was working at a place called Blau Motors. And I took it back when I was in 7th or 8th grade. And I was in charge of sweeping up the floor and emptying the trash. And I worked an hour or two after school. And I was paid 85 cents an hour for my time. This would go back to about 1958, 59. 85 cents an hour. And people say, how could you make any money off of that? I mean, the most I could make is if I worked 2 hours, I would make $1.70 for the day. If I worked 2 hours after school, $1.70. But that was silver. That was dollars measured in silver back then. We're still on the silver standard. I was paid the equivalent of 1.7 ounces of silver for working 2 hours sweeping the floor. Today, 1.7 ounces of silver would translate into something in the neighborhood of $30. It wasn't a bad job. I worked for 2 hours a night. I made the equivalent of today's $30 an hour, or $30 altogether. Average, say, $10, $15 an hour. That wasn't bad for an eighth grader. I was glad to have it. Again, we were the wealthiest country on the face of the earth, and we could do that, except government came along and raised taxes little at a time, until now we don't know where to go for money other than to sign up for welfare and get a handout from the government. We are no longer prosperous in the sense that we go out and we actually earn our pay. And again, we have gone from the status of richest country on the face of the earth in the 1950s and 60s. We've gone from that to now the world's biggest debtor. You know, technically, it's hard to believe, but technically we are perhaps one of the least wealthy countries on the face of the earth. Why? Because if you calculate the debt, we are deep in a hole. We're not in positive black territory and black ink. We are drowning in a sea of red ink, and we haven't been forced to drink that red ink yet. But the time is coming when someone's going to have to say, hey, you guys need to pay your bills. And as a nation, we're going to say, sorry, we can't. And there will be a calamity. And we've gone from richest to arguably poorest, even though we have the cars and the homes and all the rest of that. It's hard to make people going to listen and laugh and say, well, that's a bizarre argument. Who owes more money than we do? Who owes more money than we do? Take our net worth, subtract how much we owe, and all of a sudden you find out whether we have a positive net worth or do we have a negative net worth. We probably have the most negative net worth of any people on the face of the earth. I don't know that to be absolutely true. But there's people walking around in South Africa and in the deserts, and they're walking around in a loincloth with a stick and a bowl. They got nothing, but what they have is in the black. We have tons of stuff, but we are deep in the red, and as such, we are very vulnerable. And if this goes badly, we're going to see a terrible mess. And if and when it does, it'll be in large measure because the government has taken us in my lifetime from the status of wealthiest nation in the world to one of the most vulnerable and arguably one of the poorest. We'll see. We'll watch and see, but we certainly live in interesting times. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival. Be right back. Please stay tuned.
Afraid of pain. No one wants pain to rule over their life, and you don't want the negative side effects of aspirin, ibuprofen, or prescription drugs. They can lower immunity and cause dependency. Is there a safe alternative? I'm herbalist Wendy Wilson, and I prefer willow bark and meadowsweet herbs to control pain, fever, aches, and inflammation. God's herbs are good, and you won't be disappointed. Call Apothecary Herbs for pain or extra strength pain relief formula. Toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International, 704-875-8010 or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival. We were just talking about unemployment rates, an article on unemployment rates that I believe it was U.S. News and World Report. Talked about that a little bit, some of the implications. And here's another article that deals with unemployment rates, and it amplifies one of the problems we have. I would like to know what the unemployment rate is. Without knowing, without being told some mumbo jumbo that, oh, we have only 4.7 unemployed. I don't think anybody believes that. Someone should be able to give us a number that even the government will admit that they say, yeah, that's probably about it. It's probably 10%. It's probably 15%. It's probably 20%, whatever. We should be able to get an accurate number. And there is certainly widespread perception that we can't know the truth. We can listen to different people. They might be right. They might be wrong. But where is the consensus? You know, one person argues it's this number. One person argues it's that number. We don't know what the number is, and we should. If we can't even get a straight answer as to what is the unemployment rate, how can we decide what we have to do in terms of stimulating the economy, raising taxes, lowering taxes? What do? We have to have some honest numbers, and we don't have them. They are not immediately apparent, and it's clear that the government fudges these unemployment numbers, among other economic indicators. They are twisted, manipulated in order to create an impression, a belief, a level of confidence, rather than telling us the truth. Here's a second article that deals with, that touches on that same concept, and this is from Ms. Shedlock's Global Economic Trend Analysis. And the headline is, retail sector adds 323,000 jobs in 10 months, but aggregate hours worked unchanged. And they wonder why. How is it that the employment in the retail sector increased by 323,000 jobs since last August, yet the total aggregate hours worked has not budged an inch? According to Investors Business Daily, economists have been puzzled all year over how retail employment has surged, despite the fact that Walmart, Macy's, Kohl's, and other major players were closing stores and laying off thousands of workers. More, the retail hiring boom has been happening even as customers have accelerated their shift to online retailers like Amazon. Home Depot, the leader in the retail category, has done relatively well in fending off online competition, but it stopped opening new stores in the U.S. more than a year ago. Nevertheless, retailers have reportedly added 323,300 workers over the past 3 years, a spurt of growth that's nearly the best since 2000. How is it? Let me just go on. Given the retail sector's fundamentals, it makes little sense that retailers would need to hire more employees. But on closer examination, they really haven't. Not exactly. While they may have more workers, they aren't doing more work. Since August, the retail sector again has added more than 250,000 jobs, actually over 300,000, but aggregate hours worked haven't budged. Supermarkets are a notable example. Over the past 2 years, employment is up by 70,000, or 2.9%. But the sector's 2.5 million workers are working in aggregate 1.5% fewer hours per week. More workers, fewer hours. The number of U.S. workers clocking just above 30 hours has fallen to a record low relative to those who are with work hours just below Obamacare's new full-time threshold. The Obamacare shift from defining full-time employment for health care benefits from 32 hours to 30 hours is to blame. You're deemed to be working, if you're working 30 hours, you are now deemed to be working full-time. And I don't know how that, what used to be, and it wasn't that long ago, 40 hours was full-time. Obamacare came out, and if you had an employee that was working more than, I think it was 38 hours, they were deemed to be full-time employees and entitled to certain benefits under Obamacare that the employer had to provide. So the employers said, okay, we'll work 36 hours a week. And the government dropped it down again to 34 or thereabouts. And they go, okay, we'll drop it down to 32. And the government dropped it down again to like 32 now. And the employers have kicked it down to 30, 31. As hours work declines, reported employment rises. Right? Government is saying, oh, we have our employment rates are rising, unemployment is falling. But what they've really done is more people have jobs, but they're part-time jobs. Right? They're not full-time jobs in the sense that full-time jobs were available just a few years ago. 40 hours a week? No, 30 hours a week. That means they are making a full-time job is, in theory, delivering only three-quarters as much take-home pay as was true just a couple of years ago. Why? Because thanks to Obamacare, we have reduced. Businesses have simply cut back and said, I'm not paying for all that. I'm not paying all those fees and that they're associated with Obamacare. If Obamacare says full-time work is anything over 32, fine, we're going down to 30, 31. And if Obama drops it down to 28, we'll go down to 25. And if he drops it down to 23, we'll knock it down to 20. And before you're done, a full-time job will be 10 hours a week. If you go to work more than 2 days a week, you're deemed to be fully employed. This is simply another one of these illustrations of the numbers are just not honest, and they're not reliable. And if you don't know what's really happening, it's like driving an automobile, a speedometer is, you're either going 30 miles an hour too fast or 30 miles an hour too slow. If you rely on that thermometer, it's only a question of time before you are going to have a wreck. going around the corner too fast, going over, hitting the, going too slow, and someone's going to hit you from behind. We need to know the truth, and we don't have a government that provides us with that truth. And as long as that's the case, we're going to have problems in this country. Here's another one. Touches on the idea of truth. This is from Bloomberg. And the headline is, Clinton Foundation said to be breached by Russian hackers. The Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation was allegedly among the organizations breached by suspected Russian hackers in a dragnet of U.S. political apparatus ahead of the November election. The attacks on the Clinton Foundation's network, as well as those on the Democratic Party and on Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, and these are computer attacks, they compounded concerns about her digital security, even as the FBI continues to investigate her use of a personal email server while she was Secretary of State. I see great irony in that. Hillary Clinton said, oh, everything was safe. We had the we had our little personal email server, and it was fine. Everything was fine and secure, and there was no danger. And yet, if her personal server exposed her classified email to foreign intelligence operations, well, that claim is supported by evidence now that, guess what? Foreign intelligence has been cracking into the Clinton Foundation computer. It's just irony. It's ironic that she is being caught, and even she's vulnerable. She didn't mind the vulnerability that might affect the people of the United States of America when she was using a server for her convenience. But I'll bet she's steaming over people cracking into the Clinton Foundation's computer. I'll bet she's angry about that. Didn't care about, you know, top secret documents that may affect you and me, but she certainly cares about what affects her income. Clinton Foundation officials said they hadn't been notified of the breach and declined to comment further. The digital attack on the Clinton Foundation's computers was allegedly first identified by government investigators last week. Clinton didn't even know what was going on in her foundation computer or her presidential campaign computer or the Democratic National Committee computer, all of which had been hacked. But the government said, oh, you guys got a problem. Donor information and opposition research on Donald Trump reportedly stolen from the Democratic Party has surfaced online, and the culprit has threatened to publish thousands more documents. Now, this is interesting, all right? Somebody has robbed information on Donald Trump that was being stored up by the Democratic National Committee. The Democratic Party had some damaging information that they intended to use on Donald Trump, and somebody stole copies of that information from the Democrats' computers. Okay, Russian hackers may have stolen some data about Trump from the Democratic National Committee computers. But where did the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, where did they get that data on Trump? Did the Russians Google the data off the internet? Or did the DNC Google that data off the internet? Is that where they got their information on Trump? Or is it possible that the Democratic National Committee hacked into Trump computers to steal data, confidential data from Donald Trump? If the Democratic National Committee hackers robbed Trump computers, what is their moral standing to complain if the Democratic National Committee was subsequently robbed by Russian hackers? Apparently, there is no honor among hackers. All right? What one hacker steals from one guy, another hacker can steal from the first hacker. What's the lesson here? Of course, there's no such thing as secrecy or privacy in the digital age. If you got a secret and you want to put it on, you put it on a computer that's tied onto the internet, you can't count on that secrecy being maintained. A group of hackers calling themselves Guccifer 2.0 posted another trove of documents reportedly from the DNC on Tuesday, including what they said was a list of donors who had made large contributions to the Clinton Foundation, A Clinton spokesman said that he couldn't comment on government briefings about cybersecurity, and that the Clinton presidential campaign had no evidence that its systems were compromised. Well, of course they have no evidence. Clinton is in a position right now, there are strong suspicions that Clinton has been using that foundation as a way to fund, take bribes. Right? Secretary of State, she would perform certain functions for foreign governments, foreign officials, domestic officials, on condition that they hired Bill Clinton to go deliver a speech for $250,000 in front of some audience. The speech seemed to be legitimate, but the fact of the matter was it was the payment of a bribe. Hillary performed the function as Secretary of State, sold out the American people, sold out, betrayed her obligations to the American people, engaged arguably in treason, but she did it to get money that ultimately went to the foundation that she and Bill and Chelsea were in charge of. So, of course, they can't say there's any evidence that their system was compromised. If Clinton, she's in a position analogous to that of a drug dealer who's been ripped off for 50 kilos of cocaine by some other drug dealer. The first drug dealer can't very well call cops and report the theft of his 50 kilos of coke. Similarly, Clinton's can't admit to the government or the public that their foundation computer has been hacked by foreigners who may be associated with Russian intelligence. If they make that public admission, they'll implicitly admit that Hillary's use of a private server to handle her official email may have been hacked by foreign, and may also have been hacked by foreign intelligence hackers, thereby exposing some top secret information to foreign intelligence agency, and thereby increasing Hillary's exposure to being indicted. They're caught in a bizarre situation where they've been, but it's like, again, it's like crooks can't report being robbed. They can't say somebody stole my cocaine. They can't say, hey, somebody's cracked into our computer security without implicitly admitting they probably cracked into our other computer too and stole top secret documents. And here's another one. This Clinton spokesman says, we routinely communicate and cooperate with government agencies on security-related matters. That just makes me laugh. I mean, the government, as if Hillary Clinton is cooperating with government, at least lawful government, in any meaningful sense. That's just hard to believe. Where are we? What else do we have? One of the points on this, almost certainly big money donors and even agents for foreign governments will not only be implicated but embarrassed if all of the documents that have been stolen from the Clinton Foundation are released. We're going to see trails that lead to this guy bribed the Clintons, and this guy bribed the Clintons, and these guys, and this government official, and this government agency. We're going to see that. And it's going to give us evidence of a kind of a level of corruption that goes globally. And that's what may be in the Clinton Foundation documents. Now, the question is, will they ever be released to the public? If they do, the adverse consequences, the U.S. and the foreign officials and their governments might constitute the biggest scandal since World War II. We're out of time. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival. Be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day, and pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dream, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. Money, money.